Hello and welcome to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. I'm your host, Robert Streit, and Men's Magazines focuses on the arts, culture, commentary, and in-depth news reporting as found in both the domestic and the international editions of GQ, Esquire, and Men's Health. On January 6th, 2021, Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol in an effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Five people died in the attack and hundreds more were injured. On March 12, 2025, Kilmar Abrego Garcia was detained by ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, and later deported to the CECOT prison in El Salvador over allegations that he was a member of the criminal MS-13 street gang. Abrego Garcia, an illegal immigrant with a work permit and married to a U.S. citizen, is one of a number of immigrants and U.S. citizens alike swept up in illegal immigration roundups by ICE and the Border Patrol and either detained at length or deported without proper due process during 2025. To say the least, these are turbulent and dangerous times for America, its citizens, and its emigres. As we seek more peaceful and more just routes forward toward border and election security, we will be reading articles on race and rioting in this edition of Men's Magazines for the fourth week of April 2025. We will begin with Anatomy of a Riot, a GQ investigation into an immigration-related riot in Great Britain, and follow up with an Esquire piece on the re-emergence of Nazism in America. Sound like fun? No, not really, I can hear you thinking, but these times call for clear-eyed investigation and education. As always, I'll read and you will decide what's helpful and most relevant this hour. Before we begin, though, I must mention that Men's Magazines includes adult content and, on occasion, language which some might find offensive. Having said that, I encourage you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Men's Magazines. Last summer, the murders of three children in a small seaside town in England's northwest triggered a contagion of violence that spread throughout the country practically overnight. The speed and ease with which the riots took shape, propagated by angry men, distorted by social media falsehoods, and amplified by anti-immigrant opportunists, helps explain why this moment, when the truth is so fraught, is making life in the UK, the US, and beyond feel so dangerous. Anatomy of a Riot by Sean Flynn. The morning after the first terrible thing happened, Patrick Hurley was on Tith Barn Road near the corner of Hart Street, cradling a bouquet of lilies and pale green chrysanthemums. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, was in Southport as well, and she had her own bundle of flowers. She walked a half step ahead of Hurley as they crossed the street to a low, curved wall with a hedge on top, where a dozen or so news crews watched them lay their flowers among those already on the sidewalk in a makeshift monument. They stayed for a moment near the police tape, reading notes others had left, whispering to each other, but they did not speak to the cameras because really there was little left to say. 24 hours earlier, in a studio called the Heart Space, a 17-year-old boy with a kitchen knife attacked 13 people. 11 of them were children on summer holiday. They were there to practice yoga and make bracelets and dance to Taylor Swift songs. Three girls, ages 6, 7, and 9, were killed. There was no apparent motive, no obvious reason. How could there be to butcher children? Other than a disturbed spasm of horrific savagery. Hurley had been in London that morning, Monday, July 29th, which also happened to be the first day of his fourth week as the Member of Parliament for Southport. He'd been elected only 25 days earlier in a Labour landslide that ended 14 years of Conservative governance in the United Kingdom. In fact, Hurley is the first Labour MP ever elected to represent Southport, which, despite the name, is a town in the northwest of England, on the coast, just beyond Liverpool. It doesn't matter if you've been there for 3 weeks or 30 years, he says, responding to a slaughter was unprecedented for an elected official in those parts. He put out an anodyne statement of thoughts and prayers and a promise to stand strong against this mindless violence, and then got on a train to Southport, a sleepy little seaside town, Hurley calls it, which is apt. Not much excitement, in a nice way. Hurley met with local officials that evening, and in the morning he laid flowers with the Home Secretary while reporters quietly watched, and it was somber and subdued and unbearably sad. A few hours later, Hurley was back in Tithbarn Road. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who'd been in that position for precisely as long as Hurley had been an MP, had come to add his own flowers to the growing pile. But the atmosphere, Hurley says, had completely changed. There were many more people, several holding cell phones to film videos that would be posted to Facebook and TikTok and X. As Starmer approached with a small wreath, two or three started to yell things at him. How many more children have got to die on our streets, Prime Minister? A big bald fella said, How many more children? Is it mine next? And then he turned and asked no one in particular, Is he going to stand up for our children? And then the second terrible thing began to happen. By the evening, we kept getting calls, Ibrahim Hussein says. We were told that the social media was going berserk, that something's not right, something's brewing, and that you need a lot of protection. Hussein assumed there must be a misunderstanding. He'd lived in Southport for 20 years, and one thing he particularly enjoyed was the lack of things brewing. A very nice, sleepy town, he says, full of old people and retired people, and there is nothing happening here. Nothing. So when I decided to retire, I came here. He used to keep a mini-market in London, and now he is the chairman of the Southport Mosque and Islamic Cultural Society Center, which has been there even longer than him, 30 years. It's in a building in the middle of town, a short walk from the train station and the wide medians of Lord Street. They, Hussein, the mosque, the people who worship there, are as much a part of Southport as Victoria Park or the Lawnmower Museum. The murders happened just about 3 minutes, 4 minutes walk from here, he says. Indeed, the corner where the police cordoned off Hart Street for the memorial is halfway between the mosque and the crime scene. Obviously, we were all devastated, just like everyone else. He expected to attend the vigils, to lay flowers at the memorial, to stand with the other clerics and mourners. He wanted to do those things, wanted to bring comfort to his community as best he could. But the night before, just hours after the murders, he started getting calls. So we started to watch some of it and hear some of it, and we got a few more messages, he says. And this is on that very same evening. Earlier Monday afternoon, a neo-Nazi calling himself Stimpy, the Nazi flag and Nazi armband were clues, had created a channel on Telegram called Southport Wake Up. Within hours, someone posted a graphic of a bloody handprint beneath the words, Enough is enough. Below, stacked in five lines of bold type, were Protest. Tuesday, 30th July, 8 p.m., St. Luke's Road, Southport. The mosque is at the corner of Sussex and St. Luke's Roads. A second graphic showed a man wrapped in a gray baklava with a hoodie pulled tight around his head. No face, no case, it read. Protect your identity. That struck Hussein initially as peculiar, possibly absurd. The mosque's only connection to the murders of three little girls is that it happened to be in the same town. At that point, only hours after the attacks, authorities had not released the suspect's name or any details other than that he was a male and had a knife. Publicly, he was a cipher. Yet, social media was full of certainty. By nightfall, a writer with the European Conservative wrote on X that a migrant stabbed numerous children at a holiday nursery. The American right-wing commentator, Andy Ngo, who wrote a book about Antifa's plan to destroy the United States, reported the news straight to his 1.6 million followers. Mass stabbing. Suspect apprehended. But then added this odd context. Last October, an illegal immigrant stabbed an elderly Englishman to death in Hartlepool for Islam in Gaza. Ngo did not explain why that was relevant. Accused rapist and alleged human trafficker Andrew Tate, who nonetheless has 10.5 million followers on X, began a 3.5-minute rant with, "So an undocumented migrant decided to go into a Taylor Swift dance class today and stab six little girls." Even one of the replies to Patrick Hurley's statement included a screenshot from a fake news site that claimed the suspect was a teenager named Ali al-Shakati, who'd sneaked into England by boat and was on an MI6 watch list and was known to Liverpool Mental Health Services. None of that was true. But it was out there, tumbling through the ether like vapor and then condensing in fat, oily drops on places like Southport Wake Up. Another graphic, two lines of type, "Islam attacks again. How many more times?" Overlaid on a satellite map of Southport. The mosque was circled in red. "It didn't sound like the Southport I know," Hussein says now, "but you could tell that these messages were coming from outside of town, okay? You see, these are not locals. These are an organization from somewhere that is planning to come and, you know, are determined to do some trouble." It was understandable that such a monstrous crime would send shockwaves far outside the little English town where it was committed. But before there'd even been time to grieve, those first waves were bouncing and echoing and being distorted into something else entirely, a sort of rallying cry for a cause that had little to do with Southport and nothing at all to do with three dead little girls. Hussein lays his hands on his desk, slumps a little, as if he's exhausted by things he cannot change. "All I could do was wait, really," he says. "There was nothing else you could do." The next day, Tuesday, Hussein checked in with the local police. The Home Office sent security. During midday prayers, he told the congregation, "There is a lot of trouble coming our way." He skipped the vigil in the early evening so he wouldn't be a distraction. Shortly before 8 o'clock, he was in the courtyard behind the low wall fronting the road, with the Home Office security and three young Muslim men. "Just about 8 o'clock, it started to build," he says. "There were a couple of blokes standing on the other side looking over the fence, and then the 2 became 5, and the 5 became 50, and the 50 became 500. And then the abuse started, and the chanting started, you know, the F words and the C words and all that. And someone yelled, 'We want our country back,' and the crowd picked up the chant. And then, 'Who the fuck is Allah?' And the crowd joined that one, too." Men. The mob was almost all men, advanced on the courtyard wall, moving as a single unit. They kicked at the brick base, pushed on the fencing. One panel went down, then a second, and then the entire wall. Rioters grabbed loose bricks from the pavement, hurled them at police and windows. A man in a black T-shirt threw a brick, jumped on the hood of a white sedan, then went back for another chunk of broken wall. "We decided, obviously, this is getting out of hand," Hussein says. "So we went inside and we locked the door. Unfortunately, it was a PVC door, you know, one of them plastic ones. Anyone can kick that and go in no time at all." Hussein and the rest of them, 7 men in all, went to the second floor to Hussein's office. It's small, cramped, but they could monitor the security cameras, see any threats coming. They locked themselves in. "It was a wooden door," he says. "They can also break through it, but at least we're all here. If we're all in one place, perhaps we can defend ourselves somehow." Norman Wallace learned about the stabbings within an hour. He was standing by the front gate of Southport Pleasureland, the seaside amusement park he owns. Flume rides, a big swinging pirate ship, when a frantic lady scrambled up to him. "Close the gates," she said. "You've got to close all the gates. There's a madman stabbing people in town." The shock was almost numbing. The grief, he knew, must be unfathomable. Did he know any of the families? If not, then he surely knew someone who did. Almost 95,000 people live in Southport, but the place has always felt smaller, tighter. In a curious way, it was an intensely personal crime, even among strangers. Yet it was, of course, a very public crime, and in a country that has not yet dulled itself to the killing of children, within an hour, emails were pinging the office inbox, people canceling their bookings for Pleasureland. Most tourists don't want to holiday in a place where they fear they might be randomly slashed to death. And this was disastrous. Southport has always been a tourist town, and August has always been its most lucrative month. Doctors in the sooty cities used to send their patients to convalesce in the salty Irish Sea. In 1860, after iron pilings were driven into the sand, a pleasure pier, the second longest in the UK, opened. Pleasureland opened just down the beach in 1922, and it's been there in one form or another ever since, except for 2006, when the owner shut it down and Wallace bought the scraps and rebuilt everything. It's only open from spring to fall, but it still draws about 500,000 tourists every year. Neither Wallace nor Southport could easily afford to lose half a season. Wallace didn't know what was being said online because he doesn't follow social media. But the next day, Tuesday, there was a gathering on Lord Street in the center of town. There were lots of flowers, and they were doing a ceremony for the kids. And then some people noticed that there were some guys that were drinking and not part... He's searching for the right word. They were out of place, he says. And next thing, that early evening, there was smoke at the mosque. The city, part of it, was on fire. Clouds of black smoke rising into the evening air. Wallace went up to have a look. He was shocked. St. Luke's Road was impassable, clogged with police and riot gear and people he didn't recognize. These weren't people from Southport, he says. They almost looked like a military unit. Of men. Big men. A police van was burning, orange flames curling around the chassis, dissolving into the smoke he'd seen from a distance. Wallace turned around, circled the block, came from the opposite direction, and on the other side it was completely different. It was local people with kids there as well, looking to see what was going on. Everyone was like spectating this thing. He heard people talking, too, wondering where those big men on the other side came from. Rioters had set another fire, a steel box filled with donated clothing directly below Hussein's office, and the smoke poured in through an open window that he couldn't close because every time he popped his head up, someone chucked a rock or a flower pot at him. He was afraid they'd all choke to death on fumes, so they abandoned the office and took their chances in the prayer hall. But no one broke in. 53 police officers and 3 police dogs were injured before the streets were cleared. It was after midnight before it was safe enough for Hussein and the others to come out. And then it was over. Until the next night, when it happened somewhere else. Actually, it happened in 4 places the next night, including London, where police arrested more than 100 people near Downing Street. 8 people were arrested, and 1 police car was torched in Hartlepool, in the northeast. Then there was trouble in Manchester and Aldershot, too. That was Wednesday. Thursday was uneventful, and on Friday there were disturbances in Sunderland and Liverpool. Yet the seeming calm was deceptive. That first night of violence, while initiated by far-right agitators, had tapped an undercurrent of wider frustration across the UK. "There's just this magma chamber of anger across parts of the country," says Joe Mulhall, the director of research at Hope Not Hate, a UK anti-fascist research and advocacy group. And Southport shifted from focal point to trigger. A riot in Southport on Tuesday is no longer simply a news story to read in Wednesday's London newspaper. It's a TikTok video and an Instagram story and a Facebook feed happening right now and everywhere at once and then over and over again. That yob hurling a brick at the coppers might be a hopped-up miscreant, sure, but his anger is real and, to the right sort of person, visceral and righteous, which makes it contagious. So one protest, one riot in one isolated place inspires another, or maybe three others, and people post videos of those, and the cycle repeats until eventually, hopefully, all the social fuel, that magma chamber of anger, is spent. There was a time, and not that long ago, when posts on a channel like Southport Wake Up were the isolated scribblings of unlikable shut-ins. Stimpy, the neo-Nazi, would have stapled flyers to telephone poles, most of which would have been torn down, and maybe someone would have throat-punched him too. But modern social media is an appallingly effective amplifier. Isolated Cotswallop can now reach thousands, even millions, in a blink, and then be reposted and cross-platformed faster than any moderator could hope to keep pace. The BBC, for example, traced how a single deleted post on LinkedIn, mistakenly blaming a migrant for the Southport stabbings, was viewed more than 3 million times on X, where, under Elon Musk, pro-Nazi and white power content has blossomed. Over the weekend, the unrest that began in Southport spiked like a fever that comes with a rapidly spreading infection. There was bloody chaos in more than a dozen cities and towns, from Portsmouth on the southern coast to Blackpool just north of Southport, and across the Irish Sea to Belfast. In Rotherham, hundreds of rioters stormed a Holiday Inn Express housing migrants waiting for the government to process their asylum claims. When it was all over, on August 7th, there had been at least 29 anti-immigrant protests and riots across the country that injured more than 140 police officers, 6 police dogs, and 1 horse. The most widespread outbreak of far-right violence in the UK since World War II. During the worst of it, shortly before hooligans tried to burn the Rotherham Hotel that had been filled with migrants, Musk tweeted that civil war is inevitable, which in context could easily be read as more of a nudge than a lament. The Scarisbrick isn't the nicest hotel in Southport, but it is the most central and, from the outside, the most architecturally impressive. 5 stories of reddish brick with big bay windows and a turret on top. It was built in the 1890s in the center of Lord Street, which locals like to say, with no evidence and a slight wink, inspired Napoleon III's redesign of Paris. From the backside, there is a view of the Southport Pier stretching into the sea. In May 2020, the Scarisbrick stopped accepting tourist reservations. The street-level windows were covered with black sheeting, and the entire building was leased by the government to shelter migrants seeking asylum. The Scarisbrick was only used as migrant housing for about a year, but it still comes up when talking to locals in the context of the riots. "I'm not racist in any way, shape, or form," is how the conversation typically and sincerely begins. "But I mean, there are limits." There's some background required to understand why hotel guests from 2020 were relevant to riots 4 years later. Until this past July, the United Kingdom was governed by the Conservative Party, the Tories. who, for the past 14 years, slashed and froze British public spending. In theory, that was to get the national books in order. In effect, it made life harder. In many places, it became nigh impossible to see a doctor. People died waiting for ambulances. Public schools are falling apart, and whole city councils are going bust. Southport's iconic pier? It's closed because the decking is rotting and there's no money to fix it. And then there was Brexit. Nothing more than magic beans soaked in snake oil. For more than a decade, and yes, this is a dramatic simplification, most people's economic circumstances stagnated or deteriorated. Meanwhile, on the other side of the planet, decades of war were spawning a humanitarian catastrophe. Western governments had years of warning that a river of refugees would flow out of the Middle East and North Africa, and yet, for the most part, they were completely unprepared. The British immigration system, in particular, is a mess of backlogs and bureaucratic clumsiness. As a stopgap, the government started using hotels as shelters. In the summer of 2023, there were nearly 50,000 asylum seekers in hotels. Given the circumstances, that arguably was a humane and not unreasonable policy. Most migrants are, in fact, exhausted and desperate refugees who need to be fed and housed until the authorities can process their claims and resolve their status. Yet the shopkeeper near the hotel, who does he see? He has fewer customers than he did 10 years ago, or even 5, and he lives in a town too broke to fix its primary attraction. He'd like to retire, sell the shop, but no one is buying and his pension has tanked. And then one day, the hotel windows go dark and there are men outside smoking cigarettes and fidgeting with mobile phones and speaking a language he doesn't understand and staring at people who've lived here all their lives. He listens to talk radio, watches GB News, Great Britain's equivalent of Fox News, so he is convinced of the paradox that those men are somehow both freeloading on government perks and taking all the good jobs. The government's simply explaining its policies and the reasons for them could have avoided much of that ill will. What the Tories did, though, at the beginning of 2023 was start an advertising campaign aimed implicitly at blaming the migrants. It was called Stop the Boats, meaning the small ones ferrying people across the English Channel. But the boats will never stop. As long as people are desperate and determined and out of options, they'll keep coming. Yet the implied message is, it's their fault. The economy is stagnant. You can't find a job, can't buy a house, can't get in to see the doctor. It's all those goddamn migrants. And we must pause here for station identification. You're listening to Men's Magazines on Sunsounds Radio at sunsounds.org. And now back to our piece on the nature of riots. There is no policy failure that can't be papered over by blaming a desperate refugee. And then an exceptionally terrible crime is committed. A murderer slaughters 3 little girls and wounds 8 others and 2 adults. In the first panicked moments, there are spurts of misinformation, honest mistakes. Very quickly, misinformation is replaced by disinformation, deliberate lies, because those are more useful. A migrant killed those children easily morphs into migrants kill children, which raises the obvious questions. Don't you want to protect the children? Of course you do. But it doesn't mean a rally to protect the children, says Patrick Hurley, Southport's MP. It means a riot to burn things down. On the Thursday after the killings, one of Adam Kelwick's friends sent him a copy of a flyer that was floating around the more vicious edges of the internet. Never Forget was superimposed over a nearly year-old newspaper story about a migrant who blew himself up in front of a hospital. West Derby Road Mosque, Liverpool, Friday, 8 p.m. Kelwick is the imam at the mosque on West Derby Road, which is more properly known as the Abdullah Kilium Society, named after the British convert to Islam who founded it in 1887. For 3 days after the stabbings, he'd watched the news and heard the rumors with an undulating sense of dread and horror. When it happened, it's like a double whammy for many people in the Muslim community, he says. The first slap is the slap of shock, which everybody else in society shares. And then the second slap is, oh no, this is going to be pinned on us again. So when it happened, I'll be honest, I was saying, oh God, please don't make the guy who did this a Muslim. When the rumor was spreading that it was this Syrian guy called Ali al-Shakati, it wasn't who's just arrived on a boat, my heart sank. And then when the news got out that actually he's an African guy who's probably not Muslim, was born in Wales, it was a breath of fresh air. That information was released 3 days after the attack. The suspect was Axel Rudakubana, a 17-year-old born in Cardiff to Rwandan immigrants who later moved to the village of Banks near Southport. And then I received a briefing from the police, Kelwick continues. And oh well, actually, he had an Al-Qaeda manual at home. Police found a PDF of military studies in the jihad against the tyrants, the Al-Qaeda training manual, which is an academic analysis of a handbook introduced as evidence in the trial of the men who bombed the U.S. embassies in Tanzania and Kenya. Police also found ricin, a poison extracted from castor beans, which that manual describes under the heading Assassination with Poison. In January, Rudakubana pleaded guilty to 3 counts of murder, 10 of attempted murder, 1 charge of producing a toxin, and another of possessing terrorist materials. When Kelwick heard about the Al-Qaeda manual, he says, then it was the same sigh. And it's the sigh of the expected response of Islamophobes. They're going to weaponize this now and drag it into their agenda, and here we go again. He also knew it wouldn't just be shadow trolls like Stimpy the neo-Nazi or fringe nationalists like the remnants of the English Defense League. Nigel Farage, whose Reform Party got 14% of the vote in the July elections, campaigning relentlessly on immigration, was hinting at government cover-ups before the girls were buried. I just wonder whether the truth is being withheld from us. I don't know, Farage said the day after the stabbings. What I do know is something is going horribly wrong in our once beautiful country. Kelwick got a copy of the protest flyer around midday Thursday, and then the anti-racists, Antifa, and all those different elements automatically announced that they were going to have a counter-protest, he says. And I got this image of these 2 bunches of people laying into each other outside our mosque, and it's not good. The possibility of a new riot was not unrealistic, so Kelwick tried to calm tempers before they could flare. First, he made an Instagram video. The idea came to him while he was driving, so he's talking to a camera that his son is holding. So news has reached me that there's been a protest organized outside the Abdullah Kilium Mosque tomorrow evening, he says at the beginning. I've also seen calls online for some counter-protests. That's not how we do things at Abdullah Kilium Mosque. Kelwick is young, only 42 years old, but he has a kind of gentle wisdom, an understanding that anger and defensiveness and outrage are often counterproductive. I've sat down with people from far-right organizations, like real far-right, he says, and I've never found it a difficult task to kind of reach through to them because the image they have of Islam, of Muslims, is so grossly exaggerated that it's actually really easy to challenge it. At the mosque, we have a history of opening our doors and welcoming people in, he continued in his Instagram video. For people who showed up the following evening, there would be cold drinks and burgers and chips, he said, and also an invitation if you would be so kind, to come into the mosque. Bring your concerns in. Let's have a discussion about issues which are affecting our communities and how we can work together to solve them. The key word here being together. No, Kelwick's video, liked all of 952 times on his Instagram account, didn't change the entire world, but it shifted the mood in one small corner of it, a modest attempt to seize back some control over what was happening in his community. And on Friday night, there were indeed cold drinks and burgers, and there wasn't any violence. Partly because a heavy police presence kept the two sides separated, and partly because the anti-Islam protesters were outnumbered about 10-1, and the imam, the figurehead the original protesters had come to denounce, reached across the wrought iron fence and shook hands and answered questions and offered invitations to anyone who wanted to come back. There was a hug, too. Kelwick, smiling softly, almost sadly, with his arms wrapped around a man in a black hoodie, which was the photo all the papers published. That photo, that hug, was the sort of moment a screenwriter would have scripted, a warm coda of reconciliation and understanding after a week that began with unspeakable horror and spiraled into menacing bigotry. It seemed fitting, then, that there was a Save Our Kids rally scheduled in Liverpool for the next afternoon, because really, who doesn't want to save the kids? One of the locals who helped promote it was a former MMA fighter named Mark Scanlon. He is not a far-right goon, but rather a father of a daughter who dances at a studio much like the Heart Space in Southport. He works with troubled teens. Part of his job is literally trying to save our people's kids. 4 years earlier, in fact, the local paper wrote a profile of him. Meet the 36-year-old helping change Liverpool and its people, the headline read. His positivity has helped him develop a huge reputation across the city. Scanlon has a large social media following, but the rally was not his idea. In fact, it's unclear exactly who came up with it, but given the tenor of the preceding week, that Saturday was perhaps not the best time to be dwelling on threats to children. You've got to understand, Kelwick says, that Save the Children meant very different things to different people. For people of goodwill, which is most people, Save Our Kids is an innocuous sentiment, a sort of catch-all idea of creating a better world. For others, as MP Hurley points out, it's simply an excuse to riot. And it doesn't matter if most people are appalled by that, because a riot doesn't require a lot of willing participants, nor do widespread riots, Blackpool, Portsmouth, Belfast, require a mastermind. We're in the post-organization phase of the far right, Mulhall says. There is no single organization plotting an agenda, no hierarchy of grand dragons and henchmen enforcing protocol and tactics. Instead, there are thousands of individuals, Mulhall says, who operate like a school of fish. Similar beings with shared proclivities reacting to one another by reflex and habit. And they don't need a leader because, like tetras or minnows, they can respond to the same stimuli at the same time, even if they're on the far side of the school, separated by great distances. Almost immediately, the rally collapsed into a riot, serious disorder, as the local paper, The Echo, put it. Some of the people who'd supposedly come to save their kids threw rocks and cans at police, knocked one officer off his motorcycle. That chant heard in Southport, "Who the fuck is Allah?" started up in Liverpool. Parents with their children were forced to run up Water Street this afternoon, The Echo reported, after a protest boiled over on the Strand in Liverpool city center. None of this was what Scanlon and many others there that afternoon expected. A lot of his Muslim friends were coming to him saying, "What are you doing? Why are you taking people to this racist rally?" Kelwick says. But Mark doesn't sign up for far-right ideology. He doesn't sign up for Islamophobia or racism or anything like that.
Scanlon reached out to Kelwick, a friend of a friend, the imam hugging the protester in that morning's newspaper. He wanted to explain, wanted counsel. As it happened, Scanlon had been invited on a podcast with a fellow named Richard Grannon, who, among other things, hosts weighty discussions on his YouTube channel. Grannon leans pretty far left on some issues and pretty far right on others, but has contacts across the spectrum. Scanlon and three other Liverpudlians had already planned to talk with Grannon for a podcast about the riots, and they invited Kelwick to join them. Grannon posted the video of that discussion on August 14th, 2 weeks and 2 days after the murders in Southport. The protests and riots had died out by then, smothered by counter-protests and depleted by arrests. By the end of August, almost 1,300 people had been arrested and nearly 800 had been charged with various offenses. It was an interesting conversation in which all participants agreed that a handful of bad people were deliberately causing unrest. "It's a fucking jar full of ants," Scanlon said, still stung by having been wrongly labeled as an organizer of the event. "Who's shaking the jar? To me, that's the question." No one really had an answer, not a specific one. Sure, there's Elon Musk tweeting about civil war, and GB News carping about migrants and liberals, and Nigel Farage wondering what happened to his country, and there are countless online voyeurs who like watching the ants tumble and sparkle and gnaw on one another every time the jar is shaken. But the point is, in that moment in a podcast studio, those particular people were talking to each other, and they still are. A month later, Kelwick and Scanlon packed a couple of buses with kids, Muslims and not, who'd mostly never mingled, and drove them into the Welsh countryside for the day. And Kelwick and Grannon are close now. They go on long late-night walks in the Wirral and Liverpool to talk through how to sort out the world, and they're each a bridge to different social spheres. So now, when rumors spread, there's an open line of communication. From the riots, Kelwick and Scanlon and Grannon built relationships that keep them connected. "I don't want to force the narrative, as it were," Kelwick tells me, "but I think that would be a really nice thing to get out of this, is looking at the relationship, all the friendships, what's been built between Richard and me as an outcome of the riots." The night of the riots, Norman Wallace, the man who owns Southport Pleasureland, was so rattled by what he'd seen that he ventured into a space he'd long avoided. "I actually did go on social media," he says. "And I said, look, these people are going to need help tomorrow. People knocked down walls. They smashed people's cars and just wrecked everything. It was terrible. So I thought as a community we should come together and show solidarity and do the right thing." Locals were out just after dawn with brooms and shovels, picking up bricks with their hands until a small loader arrived. Later, masons would come to rebuild the walls, and glaziers would repair all the windows, and eventually the mosque on the corner of St. Luke's Road was put back together. Ibrahim Hussein slept late that morning. "Obviously, it was a long night," he says, "and didn't arrive until almost 10 o'clock when the cleanup was well underway. We were overwhelmed by the support and the kind words and people standing with you," he says, and with a small catch in his throat, too. "They all came with lovely messages, and even a small child, they say, you know, 'What do you want me to do?' Which is beautiful." He nods at that thought. He's sitting at his desk beneath the window where smoke poured in that night, smoke that he feared might choke him to death. But now there's a brilliant shaft of autumn light crashing through it. "So that gives you the heart," he says, "or at least the reassurance that we are, as we suspected, living in a beautiful town." And that concludes Anatomy of a Riot by Sean Flynn. And now we're on to Esquire and Never Again Again, a Mitchell S. Jackson essay. Mitchell writes for Esquire and teaches at ASU. Nazi Germany has long been regarded as an ultimate, unspeakable evil with no possible comparisons or parallels here. Not any longer.
Election day at Mar-a-Lago, felonious 4547 gathers with MAGA faithful as America awaits its fate. Present, a delegation of far-right Germans. 4547 strolls out of a veranda in a saggy blue suit, white shirt, sans tie, and his devil red logo cap. "So where's my German friends?" he says, and beckons a group of five white dudes, including Alternative für Deutschland party candidate Philipp Anders Rau and Fabrice Ambrosini, who resigned as the youth leader of the Christian Democratic Union over allegations he flashed the Nazi salute. The Germans parrot the fight, fight, fight that 4547 chanted after a would-be assassin's bullet grazed his ear in July. He thanks his fawning guests, and they give a thumbs-up sign for a group photo. This from a man whose first wife, according to Vanity Fair in 1990, revealed that he kept a book of Hitler's speeches at his bedside, a claim he didn't deny. Who equivocated for neo-Nazis marching through Charlottesville, who was accused by his longest-serving chief of staff of having said, "Hitler did some good things." It is common to describe the Third Reich as the nefandom, the unspeakable evil, to avoid mentioning the Nazis' mass malevolence alongside anything else. But what of the paradox that Croatia, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, Italy, and Finland of the EU have swung to hard-right governance, that for those intent on dismantling a liberal democracy, Nazi Germany is an exemplar? What of Hitler praising America's westward native annihilating expansion? Of the Jim Crow South and American eugenics inspiring the Reich's Nuremberg Laws? While wholesale comparisons between the United States and Nazi Germany have often been dismissed as hasty and or hyperbolic, rather, comparing MAGA to the Third Reich ain't overblown or premature or alarmist. It is stock that beseeches. Just how close to them are we really? On November 9th, 1923, Hitler staged an unsuccessful coup known as the Beer Hall Putsch. Hitler's nascent Nazi party and coalition of nationalist groups were thwarted in trying to depose the German government. On January 6, 2021, 4547 incited a failed coup at the capital. Hitler at least served 9 months in prison for his crime, but 4547, even as a private citizen, received no consequence for his role. Facts indicative of the ill health of each democracy's legal system at the time. On February 14, 1926, 2 years removed from prison, Hitler organized the Bamberg Conference in Bavaria and reunited the socialist and nationalist arms of the Nazi Party. In that ominous meeting, he also established the Führerprinzip, or leader principle, which demanded unquestioning obedience from party members and gave him total control. The 2024 Republican National Convention, a sycophantic spectacle, paralleled Bamberg, and it has been clear ever since that most Republicans, even those who once criticized 4547, will comport themselves along MAGA lines, that they demand fealty to their leader above all else, even country. Post-prison, Hitler helped the Nazis become the biggest party in Germany, prompting the powers that be to vault him into the role of chancellor. The country's oligarchy was wrong about its ability to control Hitler. In 1934, he purged the Nazis of several foes during the Night of the Long Knives. When President Paul von Hindenburg died a month later, Hitler combined the offices of president and chancellor into a Führerprinzip. He instigated the infamous Night of Broken Glass pogrom in 1938 and sent 30,000 Jewish men to concentration camps, the Nazis' first mass arrests of Jews for being Jews. America's oligarchs have leaned into MAGA rule,
Elon Musk invested $277 million into re-electing 4547. Jeff Bezos forbade his Washington Post from endorsing Kamala Harris. And LA Times owner Patrick Soon-Shiong likewise. Mark Zuckerberg announced the abandonment of third-party fact-checking across all Meta platforms, which boast 3.2 billion daily active users. Meta and Amazon and McDonald's and Walmart and Ford and umpteen conglomerates have caved to MAGA's anti-DEI campaign. Unprecedented millions have been donated to 4547's inauguration fund. But what if the billionaires and the operatives and politicos are as wrong about the efficacy of their machinations as their counterparts were during the Reich? A few months after he became chancellor, Hitler coerced the Ministry of Propaganda, which imposed control over all media, into being. That same year, the Reich instituted the new editor's law, forcing editors to omit anything calculated to weaken the strength of Reich abroad or at home. MAGA's propagandic tools include Fox News, The Washington Examiner, The Epic Times, and Truth Social, which 4547 founded, owns, and exploits. Quotidian, 4547 platforming blatant mischaracterizations, incendiary speech, naked racism, and flat-out lies. Plus, his persistent portrayal of mainstream media outlets as the enemy of the people. The same exact phrase used by Hitler to target Jewish people. Add to that poisonous phrase 4547's use of the term fake news and his first administration's admitted use of alternative facts. Plus, the omen that 4547 won a $15 million defamation settlement from ABC for George Stephanopoulos, claiming on air that a jury in a civil case had found 4547 liable for rape, when the judge in the case wrote that the jury found Mr. Trump did exactly that. 4547 sued the Des Moines Register for election interference, for releasing a poll days before the presidential election that understated his support. In a press conference about that lawsuit, he was asked if he'd pursue more defamation lawsuits against media outlets, journalists, and even influencers.
I think you have to do it because they're very dishonest. We need a great media. We need a fair media, he said.
4547's disregard for facts and truth and integrity, the greasing of mechanisms for dis and misinformation by outlets controlled by MAGA allies, the signs that media will accede to authoritarian power, all resemble the reign of the Reich. In 1933, the Reich also instituted the law for the restoration of the professional civil service, which excluded Jews and political opponents from all civil service positions. Parallel. One of the agendas laid out by Project 2025 is purging the U.S. government of civil service employees who have not been vetted as loyal to MAGA. We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected, said Russell Vaught, a Project 2025 architect who ran the Office of Management and Budget in the last half of 4547's first term. When they wake up in the morning, we want them not to want to go to work because they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want to put them in trauma. The Reich also legislated the Enabling Act of 1933, which allowed Hitler to govern by decree, a move analogous to the reported hundreds of executive orders drafted by Project 2025 authors for 4547 to sign ASAP. A president employing his power of executive order ain't new, but a president wielding a fusillade of executive orders to gut the government's system of checks and balances and seize dictatorial control within the first 180 days of office is not only unprecedented in this tottering republic, it's a foreboding echo of the Reich. 4547 has promised to invoke the Alien Enemies Act of 1798 to spur Operation Aurora and deport upwards of 11 million undocumented immigrants. Never mind this will cause manifold emotional and physical harm. Never mind there is no plan for logistics, including how to house that many humans or transport them to their home countries. And should Americans protest? 4547 has threatened to invoke the 1807 Insurrection Act, which grants the president broad power to use the military for domestic law enforcement. We want to be able to shut down the riots and not have the legal community or the defense community come in and say, "That's an inappropriate use of what you're trying to do," said Vaught. The Reich's law for the restoration of the professional civil service included removing judges who didn't comply with Nazi principles. Hitler replaced the Supreme Court with the People's Court, the Special Court, and later the Court of Honor, all kangaroo courts. In his first term, 4547 reshaped the federal judiciary. He also fortuned into appointing three justices to the Supreme Court, which, while not a full-on kangaroo court yet, is looking a hell of a lot like a joey. Last March, it ruled that states couldn't remove 4547 from their ballots for his role in an insurrection. Then in July, the court's Republican-appointed supermajority belatedly and flabbergastingly ruled a former president is entitled to absolute immunity from criminal prosecution for actions within his conclusive and preclusive constitutional authority. And despite all that obvious impartiality, 4547 has been unabashed in bashing courts that haven't sided in his favor. 4547 has forged a justice system that works most of all for him. The Reich's ideal of a master race catalyzed its attempt to exterminate European Jews. Prior to that astounding inhumanity, it manifested as subjugating them to the lowest of the low in every imaginable way. On the other end of the racial hierarchy were able-bodied straight Aryan men. A semi-subtle way, the able-bodied straight white men who rule MAGA are promoting the idea of a master race is the anti-DEI movement. The tacit claim is that identity is chief in whatever a black person or other has achieved, that black people are unqualified no matter our resume or experience, which is to assert that we are inherently unqualified, code for genetically inferior. A crucial reminder that Hitler was appointed chancellor in 1933 and killed himself in 1945, that a mere 12 years of Reich rule turned Germany into a genocidal autocracy. In addition to the unspeakable, the Reich's tactics allowed them to seize territory. They called it Lebensraum, living space. How close are we to the Third Reich? Did you see Elon's Nazi salute? Try how on earth do we reverse course when we're this deep into it. Well, there you go. A fair amount of food for thought. I'm your host, Robert Stride. I've enjoyed reading these challenging articles for you. I look forward to reading for you again next week. Between now and then, take care of yourself. Take care of one another. Chew on what we've read. I know I will. We can begin, hopefully, planning a better way forward. Peace.